But it's great to be here, and we got, if cloudy weather, at least it's pretty good weather. And I know I was talking with Byford before, and I know all of us are aware of what happened in Haiti. The tragedy they have over there, we just, every time you hear it, it's just worse, you know. And just disasters like that just kind of shock us, I guess, when we hear it. And can't hardly take it in. All we can do is pray for the people, maybe contribute money or whatever we can do. But we all know we live in a dangerous world, and things like that could happen at any time. You know, the very same thing could happen to us since we live on an earthquake zone ourselves. And, you know, different ones will tell us to be prepared, and it makes sense to prepare as best you can for an emergency, to maybe put water, food, whatever you can do to be prepared. But when we look at what happened over there and we see the magnitude of it, you just know that you can't fully prepare for whatever disasters happen. You can do your best, but you can't fully prepare for all things. And so the best thing we can do is be spiritually prepared. Trust in God. You know, we can do all we can do for ourselves, but when it gets really bad, you just have to trust in God and try to stay spiritually strong and close to God and trust Him for our protection. And we should try to conduct our lives to reflect our faith and just conduct ourselves the way God would have us. And I was looking in, really wondering what to talk about, and Isaiah 58 kind of caught my eye. In fact, in my Bible, and I have the Contemporary English Version because it's kind of easier to read today for that. It's titled True Religion, and more or less says what pleases God, what He likes to see in us. And it also says some things He doesn't like to see, too. So let's just turn to Isaiah 58. Isaiah 58, we'll just start in verse 1. And we'll kind of see what He really doesn't like, what kind of attitudes are not pleasing. Isaiah 58, verse 1. Shout the message, don't hold back. Say to my people Israel, you've sinned, you've turned against the Lord. Day after day you worship Him and seem eager to learn His teachings. So just a show of worship is not what He's looking for. You act like a nation that wants to do right by obeying His laws. You ask Him about justice and say you enjoy worshiping the Lord. Yet you wonder why the Lord pays no attention when you go without eating and act humble. But on those same days that you give up eating, you think only of yourselves. You abuse your workers. You even get angry and ready to fight. No wonder God won't listen to your prayers. Do you think the Lord wants you to give up eating and act as humble as a bent over bush or dress in sackcloth and sit in ashes? Is this really what He wants on a day of worship? So He's not looking for just a show and acting humble and just making a show of things. He's looking for sincerity. In verse 6, I'll tell you what it really means to worship the Lord. Remove the chains of prisoners who are chained unjustly. Free those who are abused. Share your food with everyone who is hungry. Share your home with the poor and the homeless. Give clothes to those who need, in need. And don't turn away your relatives. Then your light will shine like the dawning sun, and you will be quickly healed. Your honesty will protect you as you advance, and the glory of the Lord will defend you from behind. When you beg the Lord for help, He will answer, "Here I am." So just going to church, which is important, we should go, and putting on a show is not going to get it. But living, putting those principles that we learn to work in our everyday life is what God wants to see. He wants to see humble us, and He wants to see us sincere. Let's skip down to verse 13. He also wants to see us obeying His laws and His statutes. Verse 13. But first you must start respecting the Sabbath as a joyful day of worship. You must stop doing and saying whatever you please on this special day. Then you will truly enjoy knowing the Lord. He will let you rule from the highest mountains and bless you with the land of your ancestor Jacob. The Lord has spoken. So it's not really a heavy burden that He puts on us, but He does expect us to be sincere and to keep His holy days. And to and if we do that, we're promised great blessings. Let's turn to James 1. James 1, 26 and 27 says, if you think you are being religious but you can't control your tongue, you are fooling yourself and everything you do is useless. Religion that pleases God the Father must be pure and spotless. You must help needy orphans and widows and not let this world make you evil. Again, it's just reinforcing what pleases Him and what He expects. And turn over to James 4, the fourth chapter. James 4, 6 and 7. In fact, God treats us with even greater kindness, just as Scripture said, God opposes everyone who is proud, but He is kind to everyone who is humble. Surrender to God, resist the devil, and he will run from you. So again, we need to be humble and not proud, and we'll be rewarded for it. In closing, let's turn to 1 Peter chapter 4. First Peter chapter 4, 8 and 9. Well, I'll start in verse 7. Everything will soon come to an end, so be serious and be sensible enough to pray. Most important of all, you must sincerely love one another because love wipes away many sins. Welcome people into your home and don't grumble about it. I think in some versions it says love covers a multitude of sins. And that seems to be always the theme is love your neighbor as yourself, love your God with all your heart and all your soul. And if you do that, you can't go wrong. Thank you.
The title of this message is The Talmud or Oral Law and Christ. So how did Christ respond to the Talmud or the Oral Law? And I think for some people it might be surprising. Let's go to the encounter, Mark 7. It's also mentioned in Matthew 2, but let's look at the Mark one today. Mark 7, we'll pick it up in verse 1. Mark 7, verse 1. Then came together unto him the Pharisees and certain of the scribes which came from Jerusalem. By the way, they sent a scouting party out to check up on this Jesus Christ of Nazareth, who was creating quite a sensation, was very, very popular in the Jewish world. Which, by the way, since they were the religious leaders, that was probably not an unusual thing to do. But notice, and when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is, say, unwashing hands. Now, better translations will put it ritually unwashing hands. That's actually what it was. They found fault. Now, let me just mention something. They sent a party to check up on Jesus Christ. They didn't say a thing about the inspiring sermons he gave, how he moved the crowds, how he spoke with authority, how he did tremendous miracles. What did they report back? Pity. His disciples did not wash their hands ritually. Go on to verse 3. For the Pharisees and all the Jews, I'm not sure that word all the Jews. Let me put it like this. I think all the Jews who are religious, who went to religious academies, all the rabbis, all the... But I'm not sure if every single working man in Israel, every time they touched a piece of bread, went through the ritual hand washing. It's not really clear. But one thing is clear, Christ's disciples didn't. By the way, Christ's disciples, I mean this in a positive way, were working men of diverse backgrounds. But they weren't students, rabbinical students, if you know. In other words, he did not call the elite Bible scholars as they probably thought he would. They were working men, you know, fishermen. Well, anyway, there were a wide variety of backgrounds. They were sort of, well, maybe it's like us in some ways, maybe. except they washed their hands, eat not, holding the tradition of the elders. And when they came from the market, except they wash, they eat not. And many other things thereby, which they have received to hold. And that, in other words, they have special ritual washings of pots and pans and other vessels and other similar traditions. Now let's see what Christ thought of these traditions, which are called the Talmud, Mishnah, or Midrash. Actually, we saw a movie this week called The Chosen, about the Jewish people as chosen. Actually, it's a great movie if you get a chance to see it and rent it. Now, it's not an action flick, so it's not exciting in the action sense. But it's an exciting, it's about two young boys. One is a Hasidic Jew, and the one's, I think, some middle Jewish sect, but, you know, not too far out there. And their friendship, how it started, and how the schism in Judaism tore them apart, and you get a little look at the Hasidic Jewish lifestyle. You get some feel. They're the ones that run around, if you go back east, you see a lot of them, and all black, at least their modern descendants do. They wear all black, big hats, and they have their hair in little curls. I guess they never cut their hair. I'm not exactly sure all the details, how they manage that look, and the women have skirts that I think they drag on the ground. They come right up to the ground like that, totally covered in. At any rate, you'll see them back east. I believe what happened to the Jewish people is a lot of like what happened to our legal system. See, in our legal system, when you go to court and you say something's unconstitutional, normally the courts do not go back to the Constitution and read the exact words. They go to rulings by other judges based on rulings and writings by other judges on rulings and writings by other judges, and there's some logic to it. It's kind of the application administration of the law, and I'm not saying it's simple, but when you have those several layers of application administrative decisions by judges and Congress, you're several layers away from the original Constitution. Well, in the Jewish case, now they wouldn't admit this, but from reading it, here's what I believe happened. They say the oral traditions, the things that are not in the written Bible, were still passed down, and then their top rabbis and various groups made administrative decisions on certain religious things. And you do have to make some decisions administratively. I'm not saying that you don't. So I'm not saying I totally understand it. And because when they went to exile, two things got them in trouble with God: Sabbath breaking and idolatry. So they made a ton of laws about Sabbath breaking and idolatry. One of the first things you'll notice in the ministry of Christ, anybody who's read the Gospels know, Christ went out of his way to challenge their rulings on the Sabbath. They were too strict, too awkward. And I think one of the things this church is learning, at least we have learned it to some extent, is we don't try to administer the law. We're not a theocracy anyway. We teach the truth. But hopefully we won't come up with a ruling. You can wash 3 pots on the Sabbath, but not more than that is work. Or you can wash 3 teacups, but you can't wash four. And it's an individual thing, my opinion. For some, especially women who are more concerned about the kitchen than men are, men are slobs. Now, really, some of us could care less about the condition of the sink. For some women, they probably would be more uncomfortable on the Sabbath with four unwashed dishes sitting in the sink. And others would say, just don't worry about it. We can do it the next day. So we don't get into that. But the Jewish community was into that. And it's understandable how they got into it. So they look at the writings by various rabbis and conclaves of rabbis. And they have their own traditions. By the way, all traditions are not bad. All traditions are not bad. It's just, well, we'll see how this works out. First of all, I'm going to try to describe from what I've heard, and then I'll read something in a minute, on what the ritual washing was. It was not a hygienic washing, where you get some soap and you do all this and you rinse. And it wasn't that kind of scrubbing, like the hygienic hand washing. They would get a cup of water, and they would start at the wrist and dribble it down the wrist in a certain way. Then they'd put a few drops in the palm of one hand with the other fist and scrub it, and then they would switch to the other one. Now, my description may not be exactly. Then they would drip some water. It had to go down the fingers, and it kind of hang there. I'm told the Pharisees actually be more righteous. They start at the elbow and let it go all the way down. We can maybe argue about the details of this ritual hand washing. And they prayed a prayer doing it. Now, I'm going to read a little something off the internet about it. I was even told that some even have special cups with two handles to protect their ritual purity. I'm not even sure how that fits, but just think about it for a minute. Anyway, now this is from the internet. The procedure is to pour water out from a cup or glass, first twice over the right hand, then over the left hand, you know, doing all that stuff I mentioned. Care being taken that the unwashed hand does not touch the water used for the washing. That's where the two handles, I think, come in. You got to imagine that in your mind. The hands are then dried with a towel before taking of a meal. A benediction is recited while you do the ritual hand washing, you know, dribble over. Blessed art thou, O, you know, eternal God or Jehovah, our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with thy commandments and has commanded us concerning the washing of hands. So every time you grab a piece of food, you're doing this stuff and you're reciting the prayer. The problem is, and I understand how it happened, at least I think I do, knowing human nature, they made the mistake of elevating their oral law, their traditions, the administrative decisions they made about religious life, to the same level as the Bible, as the same level as the written law. And that's what Christ didn't like. It's dangerous. It's wrong. Let me just tell you how proud they were of this hand-washing rituals. Supposedly, there was a rabbi who was caught not doing it. He was kicked out of the synagogue and shunned, which is very serious business. Another rabbi, this is one of their stories, he was imprisoned by the Romans and only given a cup of water and a little piece of bread as his ration. He almost died of dehydration because he refused to eat his little chunk of bread until he first took what little water he had and used it in the ritual dripping. So he had very little left. But he wasn't going to stop doing it. He survived. They let him out before he died. And the Jews were so proud of him. Just think of that. A little bit of water, but he's going to use it for rituals instead of drinking while he's in the dungeon. Now, to us, that seems obviously self-righteous, silly. But I think what happens is these kinds of things grow subtly, little by little, and it catches you before you knew it. and so they didn't talk about Jesus' sermons, his powerful miracles. No, they wanted to fight about the ritual hand washing. Verse 5, then the Pharisees and scribes asked him, this is done publicly to embarrass him, of course, why walk not your disciples according to the tradition of the elders, beating hands without, and it's better translated, ritually unwashed hands? Because Christ was not promoting filthiness. I know you can take it out of context, but that's not what he meant. Verse 6, he answered and said to them, well, has Isaiah prophesied of you, hypocrites? Christ called them hypocrites. As is written, this people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Now, that's Isaiah 29:13, by the way. So Christ said, your heart is far from me. With the mouth, you're so godly and you're so religious, but deep inside, you're really not that godly. And I think we have to resist the same tendency, because the same human nature is in us as in the Pharisees and scribes. And here's how human nature is. Human nature wants to be seen as righteous. Whatever I'm doing, it's good. But really, deep down, human nature, at least in many ways, is ungodly and doesn't really want to keep God's law. And, you know, there are other scriptures in Galatians 5 where Paul describes human nature. Most of you know those verses. You know what I mean. So, Christ called them hypocrites. By the way, you'll notice they never had a good reply to any of Christ's criticism. Eventually, they learned not to ask Christ any embarrassing questions, because he always turned the question back on them and embarrassed them. And you'll see that in Luke 20:40, where they eventually learned, don't ask him any more questions. We're losing all the time. So they learned that the hard way. And we have to also push and try to stir up the Holy Spirit to help us have a good heart. Because deep down, we don't really want to be godly in all areas. We might kid ourselves, but we don't. We have to work on our heart. And that's what they didn't do. And they allowed things like ritual hand washings to make them think they were righteous. It was image over true substance of righteousness. Think about how righteous you would feel. Every time you took a snack, you did all this hand dripping, and you prayed the prayer, you think, oh, man, am I righteous. We have to work by getting our heart right. We want to be like David, a man after God's own heart. It's like one person said, you want your heart at church, not just your body. Heart and mind. And they were image over substance. I'm going to read this joke. Now, this is a different joke than any I've told before. And I didn't pick it out, so somebody else will take the blame if you don't find this funny. But it's different than any joke I've seen. Mr. Doofus has one brilliant cousin. He's a psychologist, Dr. Doofus. So they asked Dr. Doofus some questions, see how smart he is. How do you put a giraffe into a refrigerator? He thought for a second, well, with that neck, that's going to be hard to do. The correct answer is, open the refrigerator, put the giraffe in, and close the door. So then they ask him, how do you put an elephant in? You know, he says, the same way? No, wrong. You have to open the refrigerator, remove the giraffe, and then put the elephant in. Then they ask him another question. The lion, king of the jungle, was hosting a conference for all the animals. Which animal did not attend? Dr. Doofus says, the zebras, because, you know, lions eat them. Wrong. Not the zebra, the elephant, because he's in the refrigerator. Then they ask him another question. If you're in the jungle and you're trying to cross a river, and a river used by crocodiles, and you don't have a boat, what do you do? And Dr. Doofus says, wait a minute. He says, I assume there's no bridge, right? There is no bridge. I don't know. The answer, you jump in the river and swim across. Why? Because all the animals are at the lion's conference, including the crocodiles. Now, according to Anderson, who did this survey worldwide, 90% of professionals fail this test, while the majority of fourth graders got it right. So that shows you people who think they're so smart aren't so smart. And that kind of reminds me of the Pharisees. I'm sure they thought they were great religious leaders, experts on the Bible, and they weren't so smart. Now notice, getting back to Mark 7, their traditions were even worse than what we thought. You're going to pick it up, Mark 7, verse 8. Here's what Christ says. Well, I'll start in verse 7. Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. And then he gives an example, verse 8. For laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men as washing of pots, cups, you know, hands, and other such things you do. He said unto them, by the way, they got thick books on books of the Talmud and Mishnah. I mean, it's a lot of stuff. By the way, you'll see in The Chosen, they ask the boy who's not a Hasidic Jew a tough Jewish question, and he could quote, he knew exactly which rabbi made the decision. So I guess they teach this in their temples, and, you know, they're steeped in as much of their traditions and decisions by rabbis as they are the real Bible. At least that's the impression you get when you read it. I mean, you see the movie, if you ever get to see it. Verse 10, for Moses said, honor your father and your mother. Whoso curses father and mother, let him die the death. Now, what you take out of that is, honor means you help take care of them. Because you're going to ask me, what did the elderly do before Social Security? Their children, grandchildren, and other relatives took care of them. That was expected. You know, you have some kids, and then when you're too elderly to do anything, you move in with them, or they move in with you, and they take care of you. Really, that is what happened. You know, there are times when I wonder if that wasn't better for society in some ways, because those older people could help with the children and grandkids. At any rate, pass on a little bit of family history. So they were expected to honor their parents by taking care of them. But notice, but you say, verse 11, if a man, because they're the ones setting the religious rules now, if a man say to his father or mother, it is korban, spelled with a Q, apparently not just a C, that is, say, a gift by whatsoever thou mightest profited me, they shall be free. And they don't have to take care of their parents. And korban meant you dedicated, say, this big chunk of money you had, or goods that represent money. You said that money is dedicated to help in the temple and to help what we might say the equivalent of the Jewish church. And because it's set aside as holy, I am relieved from helping my parents. Maybe one of my siblings will take it up. But I don't have to. And you can see from the scribes and Pharisees' point of view, they control the Jewish church and the money. So can you see how a law like that's good for them? But it's negating the child's responsibility to his own parent. And according to one commentary I heard, later in life, maybe after the parents pass away or some other sibling is taking care of them, they can un-korban the money and then have it all to themselves. Didn't have to help their parents. Clever, isn't it? Very clever. So this is even worse than putting the oral traditions on a par with the Bible. They actually end up putting them above the Bible. Isn't that pretty much what this world does? I'll bet if you, because I've actually done it, you tell someone that Christmas is pagan, who cares? I like the tradition. It doesn't matter whether God likes it or not. I mean, and I've tested several people, and that's how they feel. Maybe there may be exceptions who try to argue that it's not really pagan. They probably know, and they just don't care. Traditions over God. Anything that's nullifying, overruling the Bible is terrible. It's actually terrible. And here's an example that happened in God's church. There was a period of time, just a short period of time, but Natalie suffered through it. She'll tell you all about it. When some ministers said, you know, people, when atonement arrives, they're not really hungry. They're not really afflicting themselves. They need to start fasting at about noon the day before, at least maybe like 8 hours before sunset, start fasting. Well, within a year or so, the church realized, no, wait a minute, that's not in the Bible. I mean, you can do it if you want to, but it's not in the Bible, and it doesn't necessarily make you more righteous. By the way, see if your stomach acts like mine does. That principle doesn't work. As soon as I stop eating, within an hour or two, my stomach says, I want something in there. It doesn't take 8, 9, 10 hours for me to get hungry. It seems like the fact that I can't eat, I want to eat. It's like almost immediate. And I'm, of course, more carnal than you all are. That was an example of an administrative decision that I think was, well, it didn't contradict the Bible, but it's not what the Bible says. You start at sunset. Now, if you want to back off a few minutes so you don't break it, that's probably wise, but you don't have to wait 8 hours. Mark 7, verse 14. And when he had called all the people unto him, he said unto them, "Hearken unto me, every one of you, and understand. There is nothing from without a man that enters into him that can defile him, but things which come out of him, those are they that defile the man." Now, before we talk about those further, most Protestant commentators, these several I've seen, they pick on that verse and say, that proves you can eat all the pork you want. Christ just did away with the laws of clean and unclean meat. See how clever that is? I would argue that what Christ is really saying is a little dirt is not going to kill you. He's not saying eat anything you want. And by the way, the laws of clean and unclean meat are in the written Bible. They're not part of the oral tradition. They're in the written Bible. That puts them in a different category. And just going to say this real briefly. There are two problems with saying that that changes the laws of clean and unclean meat. One, as I say, it's in the written Bible. He's talking about oral traditions. And two, Christ was not discussing clean and unclean meats. He was discussing hand washing. So if you take an answer away from the original question, you can get a distorted answer. Now, they want that answer because they want pork. And I enjoy pork chops, too. I'll admit it. But, you know, that's really not what he's talking about. Verse 18, and he said unto them, "Are you without understanding also, his own disciples? Do you not perceive that whatsoever thing comes from without into the man, it cannot defile him, but because it entered not into his heart, but into his belly, and goes out into the drought, and it purges all meats, it should be all foods." In other words, your bowels and your digestive system will digest. You know, if you get a little bit of dirt, it'll all just be dumped out. But what you have to worry about is what goes in your heart. For instance, I was listening to a marriage counselor show, and they were saying, if you're in a battle with your spouse, you're mad about something, never curse them out. And you just really lay the tough rhetoric on them. I mean, try to use other words. They say even if you later apologize, you can't really take those words back. They've affected, they went in your heart, and they went into the heart and mind of your spouse, and it'll make any reconciliations much, much tougher. Because anything that comes out of your mouth is more a projection of your character. Going on, we'll pick it up in verse 20. He that saith, that which comes out of the man, that defiles the man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications and murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, and foolishness. In other words, that's what's in your heart. And every time you let something like that out, it affects your heart even more. In other words, let's say you say something mean and condemning to someone that you don't like. The fact that you said it openly makes your hatred for them greater. And you've damaged your heart and your character a little bit. That's what Christ is talking about. He's not talking about, eat all the pork and pig and mice, whatever you want. He's not saying that. By the way, if Christ was saying that all food has been clean, can you go out and eat poison mushrooms? Could you eat like shrimp that hasn't been kept frozen instantly and you only got a certain number of hours or it'll give you horrible stomach poisoning? Is he saying that's not true? No, he's not. Is he saying go eat roadkill and rats? any other horrible thing out there. It'll probably get you sick, you know, depending on how long it's roadkill, it can even kill you. No, he's not saying that. I know people eat that stuff. Believe me, there's TV shows about it. People eating bats and mice and roadkill. Some unbelievable stuff they eat. That is not what Christ is saying. What about arsenic? Is he saying you can eat arsenic and other there are a lot of poisonous plants. Of course he isn't saying that. What Christ is saying is guard your heart, guard your mouth. The evil that comes out of your mouth is what will hurt you a lot more than if a little bit of dirt goes in your mouth. Not that we're asking you to eat with dirty hands, but if perchance that were to happen, what comes out of your mouth is much more dangerous than what you take in your mouth. There's some evil words, you just can't take them back. And what we should strive for is a true understanding of God's written law from the heart. And if the church ever makes some administrative decisions about something, or we develop traditions, remember those traditions, whatever they are, good or bad or in the middle, are not as strong as the written law. Let me give you another example. Actually, the guy even attended here in this building a few times. He lives in Kentucky. I think he's passed away. Actually, another lady as well. They didn't believe on and ever eating in a restaurant on the Sabbath or anything like that. Well, the church made an administrative decision, which we can talk about later, that especially when people have to travel long distance, two-day Pentecost in some restaurant complex, and a bunch of other issues, the church will just be absolutely miserable, and your Sabbaths will be miserable with cold food or cold sandwiches or no food. And I understand they can go back to a scripture in Nehemiah where he didn't allow them to do all the food stuff on the Sabbath. But there's a difference there. Let me just, for those who don't know, one of the differences is Nehemiah was the governor. He had political power. And the whole society was in the church, if you want to call it, you know, Judaism, the church. If we were in that situation, it'd be a whole different ball game, wouldn't it? And actually, they weren't just selling food on Sabbath. They were doing the grapes. Now they had to mash the grapes with their bare feet. They were doing all, which is hard work, and collecting it and sealing it up and whatever they put in there, yeast and sugar. They were doing all that, and, you know, these open-air markets, what, you know, how noisy they are in the Middle East. They were doing all that on the Sabbath in a country run by Jews, full of Jews. Well, there's no need for that. We're not in that situation. But if someone comes along and says, well, I don't agree with that administrative decision, and I'll always brown bag it or not eat anything, that's fine. We didn't bother them. They're free to do what they want. If they don't agree with that administrative decision, we don't put it up there on a par with the Bible. Does that make sense? If someone now if they were to start causing trouble and fighting with people over it, then that's a whole other issue. We'll talk about that later. But, you know, if they don't want to do it, they don't want to do it. They do, you know. And that, what I'm saying is, we should try to remember to have administrative freedom for people, and that's what Romans 14 is partly about, for people to have some level of flexibility in the way they do it. We're not going to be administrators. Actually, Worldwide actually did this for a while when they were bigger. They had people go over to other people's houses and look in their covers. I'm not making this up. I didn't see it, but I heard about it. We're not going to check up on you. You can eat all the pork you want and ruin your health, and we will probably never know it's between you and God. We're not going to get into that kind of thing. but what God wants is for our heart to be right. So remember two things. One, never let traditions, even good ones or administrative decisions, reach the level of the written Bible. Two, our real goal, as far as the law is concerned, is to develop a heart after God's own heart. Try to obey and understand the laws in both the letter and the spirit in which they're written. Like the spirit of the law on stealing is saying, not only don't you take from other people, but you work and take care of yourself and maybe even have something that you can help other people with. So we want to develop a heart after God's own heart like King David.